ever climb Career Mountain and get to the top and shout, "I made it!" You will rarely feel done or complete or even successful. Most people I know struggle with that complicated soup of feeling slighted on one hand and like a total fraud on the other. Our ego is a monster that loves to sit at the head of the table, and I've learned that my ego is just as rude and loud and hungry as everyone else's. It doesn't matter how much you get, you are left wanting more. Success is filled with MSG. Ambivalence can help tame the beast. Remember, your career is a bad boyfriend. It likes it when you don't depend on it. It will reward you every time you don't act needy. It will chase you if you act like other things, passion, friendship, family, longevity, are more important to you. If your career is a bad boyfriend, it's healthy to remember you can always leave and go sleep with somebody else.
Everybody is scared most of the time.
Partner in crime. Tina Fey is my comedy wife. I've known her for almost a double decade. We met each other when we were poor and single. Now we are both rich as shit and have husbands all over the world. People think of us as a comedy team, and I am not quick to correct them. Why wouldn't I want to connect myself to the fiercest and most talented voice in the comedy world? I'm mistaken for Tina all the time. I recently renewed my license at the DMV, and the African-American woman asked me to do my Sarah Palin. She was confused and perhaps racist, but it only made me happy. I'm happy that people call me Tina because she is my friend, and she happens to be crushing it. Tina helped me get on Saturday Night Live and asked me to join her on Update as one of the first two women co-anchors. It was as fun as it looked. We have performed in front of our parents and the whole world, and each time we've looked at each other and laughed at what we get to do. Tina reminds me of how far I have come. She knew me when. When we are together, I feel strong and powerful. Maybe too powerful. I tend to show off and run my mouth a little bit. We don't compete against each other. We compete against ourselves. Often, there's only one other person in the world who understands the very specific thing I am dealing with, and it's Tina. Well, Tina and Judge Judy, actually, but I only have Tina's phone number. It is intense to have little kids in a television show and be a woman in general, and I'm lucky to have someone to walk through this weird life with. Tina shows her love for you by writing for you. I can't tell you how many times she wrote something special and wonderful for me. Most of my memories of her at SNL involve Tina sitting at her computer working on something for someone else. Tina wrote a lovely chapter about me in her book, and boy, have I dined out on that for a while. So, in an attempt to return the favor, I will honor Tina by listing some facts about her using the letters of her name. This is called an acrostic poem, arguably the laziest form of writing. T. 20 years ago, I met Tina, and we became instant friends. Our relationship is roughly the same age as Lourdes Ciccone. And like Lourdes, we think of ourselves as Madonna's daughters. I. Improvisation is where Tina shines. We have done hundreds of improv shows together, and perhaps 10 were very good. This is an excellent ratio. N. Never been attracted to the same guy. Important. A. Able to do all things well. F. Family. Tina is a great mother. E. Elizabeth is her real name, but I call her Betty. And why? YOLO, you only live once. We host all this shit and run this town because we come correct and ain't nobody gonna stop us. Fuck all y'all haters. Tina, please punch this up. Thank you in advance. I'm so proud of you. Once a woman turns 40, she has to start dealing with two things. Younger men telling her they are proud of her, and older men letting her know they would have sex with her. Both of these things are supposed to be compliments, but can often end up making this particular woman angry. I don't think a man who is 15 years younger than me should tell me he is proud of me, unless he is my sober coach or my time-travel dad. Older men can be sexy and powerful, but when a thrice-divorced entertainment attorney puts his bony hand on my knee, I want to whisper in his ear, "You're crazy, old man." I'm not sure if you've heard this new theory that men and women are different, but it's really starting to catch on. Most of my life has been spent in a room full of men, and I've learned the different ways they communicate. I find, in general, the amount of sharing men do with each other in 1 year is about the same as what I share with my female friends while we wait for our cars at the valet. I was once part of an ASCAT show that included a young comedian doing monologues. In one of his stories, he briefly mentioned his failed marriage. After the show, the comedian, 10 other guys, and I were all hanging out in the green room drinking beers. This ratio is not uncommon in comedy. If you're a woman, you are often the only one, or one of two, in a room full of men. This is certainly the case in most writers' rooms, except for SNL and Parks and Rec, which both had more women writers than many other shows, because Seth Meyers and Mike Schur, the head writers on each of these shows, respectively, are real men who love women. Anyway, back to the green room. One guy said to the comedian, "Hey, I didn't know you used to be married." And the comedian said, "Yeah." And then another guy said, "Huh." And the comedian said, "Yeah." There was a moment of silence, and then the comedian breathed deep and said, "Oh, thanks for letting me talk about it, guys." He actually felt like he had shared something. This is how men talk to each other. It's amazing to see up close. On the other hand, men are sometimes wildly inappropriate in the way they share with women. By a show of hands, how many of you have seen a strange penis on the street? On the subway? At a sleepover? I was once walking with my friend Carrie in the middle of the day, and some guy asked us for the time. When we looked down at our watches, his dick was in his hands. We giggled and screamed and ran away. We were probably 10. I've been really drunk in high school and had a guy try to fool around with me. I've been called a bitch and a lesbian when I rejected a guy in college. I've locked eyes with various subway masturbators. I've been mugged but not raped, pushed and spit on by someone I knew, and forced to pull over in a road rage incident where a man stuck his head into my car and told me he was going to come in my face. And I count myself very lucky. That is what very lucky feels like. Oof. Many women, and even some men, have their own version of how they have been lucky or unlucky. It can make it hard not to be on high alert for people using power to manipulate you, which leads me to this story. I share it because it's an example of a shady use of power and how I attempted to push back. And also, it's a story that shows no matter where or who you are, it can sometimes be hard to get a creep to stop hugging you. I was asked to perform at an event honoring someone. I had worked on my bit, and I was excited to be part of a special night for this person whom I admire. Usually, leading up to an event, you're asked to run your ideas past some producers. I've learned that with these events, I need to conserve the amount of real estate I let people take up in my heart and brain. Most people like to talk about things too much and too often, especially producers. When you're dealing with nervous producers hoping for a great show, you can be asked to take on their energy and be responsible for their feelings. I try to combat this by ignoring emails and hoping the whole situation just goes away. When that doesn't work, I spend an hour or so getting angry at myself for saying yes to the thing in the first place when I am much too busy. I'm so busy. Why won't people understand that? After I've stomped around a bit more, I usually call or email the producer late in the game and speak as vaguely and as quickly as I can. So I talked to the producers about my speech briefly and prepared to head to the event. I was ushered in to do a little rehearsal. It all went well. We went over my bit and it got a bunch of laughs. The producer was a pleasant older gentleman in his 60s who thanked me for joining and assured me I would be in great hands. I cursed myself for having been so grumpy with the production team. Right before I walked out on stage for the actual performance, the sound guy made some last-minute adjustments to my microphone. Then I walked out and started my section. My bit went fine. I would give it a B-. I'm at the point in my life now where delivering a B- performance on a televised show with some of my comedy heroes doesn't ruin my week. I don't know if that's the most inspiring or the most depressing sentence I have ever said, but there you have it. But right as I was building to the climax, the lights went down too early, and I was cut off from delivering the ending that I was excited about and that had gone so well in rehearsal. At SNL, we always wished for bad rehearsals. There was nothing worse than performing live and waiting for the laugh that came in rehearsals and then never getting it. I coined it phantom laugh syndrome. A hot dress audience was met with some head shaking because usually there was nowhere to go but down. My hot dress had morphed into me not really delivering and being cut off too early. I semi-stormed off stage and headed right into the path of the producer. "Great job," he said. "You guys missed my cue." I said, "No one noticed." "I did." "Relax. It was great." Relax is a real tough one for me. Another tough one for me? Smile. Smile doesn't really work either. Telling me to relax or smile when I'm angry is like bringing a birthday cake into an ape sanctuary. You're just asking to get your nose and genitals bitten off. "This is the part where you apologize to me," I said, getting angry. "You guys screwed up, and this is where you make me feel better about it." I like to use this tactic on people. It can work. When someone is being rude, abusing their power, or not respecting you, just call them out in a really obvious way. Say, "I can't understand why you were being so rude, because you're the concierge, and this is the part of the evening where the concierge helps me." Act like they're an actor who has forgotten what part they are playing. It brings the attention back to them, and it gives you a minute to calm down so you don't do something silly like burst into tears or break their stupid fucking glasses. Not like there's anything wrong with crying. It was Marlo Thomas and the Free to Be You and Me gang who reminded us that crying gets the sad out. It's just that sometimes anger should just stay anger, and tears can change anger to something else. However, if you do start crying in an argument and someone asks why, you can always say, "I'm just crying because of how wrong you are." So I tell this producer to apologize to me, and he kind of slinks away like, "Yeesh, she's a handful." Luckily, that doesn't bother me the way it used to. That kind of feeling would have been hard to hold in my heart and stomach when I was in my 20s. It was hard to feel like somebody didn't like me. It felt like such a failure. I don't care as much now. It's really great. It's like I can finally eat spicy food without the gut ache later or something similar. I have a stomach for other people not stomaching me. Or at least I'm working on it. So I stomped upstairs and I felt angry for about 5 minutes. And then I watched the anger travel through my body like a wave and leave. Emotions are like passing storms, and you have to remind yourself that it won't rain forever. You just have to sit down and watch it pour outside and then peek your head out when it looks dry. I had all but gotten over the whole thing when I heard a gentle knocking on my dressing room door. "Amy, can I talk to you?" He's coming to apologize, I thought, and I instantly decided I was not upset. Not only that, I decided I was going to let him off the hook easy. I just wanted to go watch the rest of the show and have a drink and celebrate. So I opened the door with relaxed shoulders and a genuine smile of reconciliation. He came in and sat down without asking me if that was okay with me. I noticed this. "We have a problem." "Oh?" "Your audio wasn't good. Your mic wasn't working correctly." "Oh." So now I realize not only was he not coming to apologize, he was there to deliver more bad news. I practiced a few things I've learned from my therapist and other badass business bitches. I sat back. Actually, I leaned back. I thought about my second book, which will be a bestseller, co-authored with Sheryl Sandberg, titled Lean Back. I uncrossed my legs and made eye contact. I immediately decided this was not my problem. And the relief of that decision spread across my chest like hot cocoa. Too often, we women try to tackle chaos that is not ours to fix. "Well, that's disappointing," I said. "I don't know what to do," he said. I practiced another new thing I've learned. I just sat there quietly. It was so hard. I once sat next to Christopher Walken as we were rehearsing a sketch for SNL. I had tried small talk with him a few times, and he was extremely pleasant, but I just felt like I was bothering him. So as an experiment, I tried to just sit next to him and be quiet. It was excruciating. I think I lasted for 3 minutes, and then I had to pretend to read a bag of chips. Not talking can be hard for me, but I tried it. I said. I know, I was technically talking. "Would you do it again? Without an audience, so we could make sure we have it for the broadcast?" he asked. "I don't think so," I said, quietly but firmly. "Well, I just don't know what to do," he said. I sat in silence. "I'm doing good so far, right?" Maybe I can do ADR if you need it, I said. ADR is recording audio over a taped piece. But notice what I'm doing? I'm starting to offer ways to fix it, even though a minute ago I felt great reminding myself it wasn't my problem to fix. That would be great, he said. Are you sure you don't want to do it again? Just so we can be sure we have it? So now he had heard my no and was still asking. Gavin De Becker talks about this in his wonderful book, The Gift of Fear. He talks about how the word no should be the end of the discussion, not the beginning of a negotiation. I am obsessed with the book, The Gift of Fear. I quote it too much. My friends roll their eyes when they hear my Gift of Fear train coming. But how can you deny such hilarious gems as most men fear getting laughed at or humiliated by a romantic prospect, while most women fear rape and death? I mean, who doesn't want me spouting that kind of stuff at their Christmas party? I said no again. I said I didn't want to go back out and do my speech again in front of an empty room. So, that should have been it, right? No. Instead, the producer stood up and said, I'm sorry, this has been stressful. Can I give you a hug? Now, I wish I could tell you I said no. And when I retold the story that night to my friends, I lied and told them I didn't let him hug me. I told them I said something like, no, no, you can't. And all my friends nodded their heads when I told them that, because they all believed I wouldn't let this guy give me a hug. I was a successful and independent woman. I was strong. I secretly disliked most new people. But I did let him hug me. I let that creepy guy hug me. I stayed seated, and he came over and hugged my stiff body while my arms stayed at my sides. And all I was thinking at that moment was that if I let him hug me, he would feel better, and this would all be over soon. Do you think he would have hugged a male performer? Me neither. Either way, it never ends.
Calling people sweetheart makes most people enraged.
This next chapter is about my experience on Parks and Recreation, and joining me in the audio booth is the creator of Parks and Rec, Mike Shore.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Welcome to my personal audio booth.
It's a beautiful booth.
Thank you.
And when did you build this?
The first time I ever got paid for a television show, I spent all of it on this gorgeous audio booth.
It's huge.
Hmm?
It's probably like an airplane hangar-sized audio booth.
And it has terrible acoustics.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yep.
You can't tell, obviously, if you're listening to this, but Amy and I right now are about a quarter of a mile apart from each other.
Physically and emotionally. I'm going to read this chapter, Mike, and, you know, I would love it if you have any thoughts or feelings, you should chime in.
Oh, great. I don't anticipate that happening, but if I have anything to say, yes, I'll chime in.
We'll see. Let's build a park. Playing Leslie Knope is as fun as it looks. I get to be the lead on a show I would actually watch. I've met friends whom I will treasure forever. I'm allowed on a weekly basis to both crack jokes and cry. It's been hard to wrangle this chapter because I still feel too close to the job to step away and share it all with you. When this book goes to print, we will be finishing our 7th and last season and shooting our 125th show. My nose is still pressed up against the painting, and I have little perspective. Because of this, I'm going to do what I've been doing for the past 6 years, which is write something and ask Parks and Recreation creator Mike Shore to make it better.
Sorry, Amy, could you just refer to me as King?
Oh, let me just check. No, I can't.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, let's continue. Every acting job feels like the end of the road. If you're lucky, you get to peek at what is around the corner. It's a privilege if a clear path is laid out that will take you to another work environment. It's rare that someone builds a bridge to the next great thing. After Saturday Night Live, my bridge was Michael Shore. The next great thing was Parks and Recreation.
My grandmother wanted me to be an engineer, and being called a bridge is probably the closest I will ever get, so I thank you.
You're welcome. Mike and I were friends and co-workers at Saturday Night Live. He was a writer before I got there and ran Weekend Update during the Tina Fey, Jimmy Fallon years. Mike is a whip-smart Harvard grad who manages to be just as compassionate as he is funny. He's a lover of justice, the underdog, and the good fight. Never is this demonstrated more than in his love for the Boston Red Sox. I watched the Red Sox win the World Series with Mike and Seth Meyers and other Boston writers.
We didn't technically watch together. You were in New York and I was in L.A., but you did call me after every single game and scream things like Ortiz into my voicemail.
Mike even turned all of those emails into a book.
The book was called Somebody Did Something, the story of the 2004 Boston Red Sox. It was every email, text message, and phone message our friends had sent me about the Red Sox from September of 2003 to December of 2004. And I had it printed and bound, and I gave it out to my friends as a holiday gift. Side note, it totally made Seth Meyers cry.
On the last page, Mike transcribed a phone message from his therapist, congratulating him on the Red Sox win.
I had not spoken to my therapist in 2 years, but she knew how important the victory would have been to me.
And I'm sure she'd be very proud of you now.
Thank you.
You're doing so well. Mike also knows all of the lyrics to Baby Got Back by Sir Mix-a-Lot, and I know this because he sang them into his cell phone while pretending to take a call on the dance floor at my wedding.
I'm currently enjoying the fact that this took place before every human in the world had an HD video camera in their pocket.
Needless to say, he has a lot of skills.
Two, really. Compiling emails and Baby Got Back-related dance bits.
Before Mike left SNL, he, Seth, and I sat in his office and watched the brilliant Christmas finale of Ricky Gervais's UK version of The Office. We all wept in our hoodies.
The moment Dawn returned to the office and kissed Tim, I jumped up out of my chair and involuntarily thrust my hands in the air like my team had just won the Super Bowl. Poehler clapped and cheered. Everyone in the room had a cathartic moment of pure joy. And I remember thinking later that I wanted to write something someday that would make people feel that good. Many of the romantic and emotional storylines on Parks and Rec have been my attempt, my and the other writers' attempts, I should say, to reach that bar.
I don't remember if Mike had already signed on to join producer Greg Daniels on the American reboot at that point.
I had not.
I remember thinking that an American version of The Office was a terrible idea.
So did I. So did everyone except, thank God, Greg Daniels.
Then I heard that Greg Daniels, Mike Schur, and Steve Carell were involved and still thought it was dicey. Then I saw it and realized it was amazing. In early 2008, Mike and Greg called me to ask if I'd be interested in working on a show they were creating once I left SNL. Greg now had a deal with NBC to develop a new series, rumored to be an Office spinoff, and had asked Mike to do it with him. We talked vaguely about ideas, but mostly just about how fun it would be to do something together. Greg's deal meant that the new show had been ordered straight to series with a 13-episode guarantee. Most shows start by making a pilot episode. When the pilot is done, a group of mysterious people gather in a room and weigh its merits, consult various oracles, and then send white papal smoke out of a holy chimney when it is decided it will become a series. Being ordered straight to series was great news because it meant we were able to skip that mysterious and painful pilot process. But on top of that, the first episode was slated to air after the Super Bowl, TV's most coveted slot. It was a remarkable and rare opportunity, a home run decision for any actor. Then I got knocked up and figured the whole thing was a bust. Mike and Greg started working on what would become Parks and Recreation, and a few months later decided to ignore my delicate condition and pitch me the idea anyway.
By this point, with the idea pretty fleshed out, Greg's and my general feeling was, Poehler or bust, pregnancy be damned.
Mike called me as he stood on the balcony of his house chain-smoking, a detail he has asked me not to put in my book.
Damn it, Poehler.
He told me about a character he and Greg had created called Leslie Knope. She was an extremely low-level Parks and Recreation Department employee who had big dreams. She was inspired by the "yes, we can" spirit of Obama's recent election. She believed that it only took one person to make a difference. She wanted to affect change. She wanted to someday be president. But most importantly, she wanted to turn an empty lot in her town into a park.
It's so interesting to think about it this way now, as we near the end. It was, at the beginning, really that simple. It was a woman who wanted to make something out of nothing.
Are you crying?
No, I'm not crying. Shut up.
This show was going to be shot in the single-camera documentary style that was working so well for The Office. At this point, I had no experience with this documentary-mockumentary-style format. Before SNL, I had done a few multicamera shows as a guest star or a featured regular. And on multicam shows, you shoot with three or four cameras in front of a studio audience, and you can hear people laughing, like Cheers or Seinfeld. Sometimes you shoot things without an audience, but at least once a week you have a tape night where an audience comes in and actors feed off the energy and laughs. My first television job was a tiny part in an episode of Spin City, which was a multicam show, in 1996. I didn't meet Michael J. Fox, but Richard Kind was kind. 2 years later, I had a part on a show called Sick in the Head, a pre-Freaks and Geeks Judd Apatow-produced pilot starring David Krumholtz, Kevin Corrigan, Andrea Martin, and Austin Pendleton. It was not picked up to series. The pilot process can be rough going. I had a little more experience in shows that shot single-camera style. Single-camera usually means using one camera and shooting each side of the scene separately. In other words, if two people are talking, you shoot over one of their shoulders and do a bunch of takes where only the person on camera is really performing. Then you stop, they adjust all the lights, the cameras turn around, and you shoot the other person. It's extremely tedious and slow. It means long hours and lighting setups, and it feels like shooting a traditional movie. Years before, I had worked on a single-camera pilot called North Hollywood, which was also not picked up to series. Though looking back, it made sense that the show didn't go. I mean, it starred a bunch of losers named Kevin Hart, Jason Segel, and January Jones, and was produced by the obviously talentless Judd Apatow. That's right, I am the common denominator in two failed Judd Apatow projects. Judd Apatow with me? $0. Judd Apatow without me? $200 trillion.
Is that mathematically accurate?
Yeah, I don't know, roughly. Mike and Greg explained their idea for a new mockumentary style, and it seemed like a hybrid of Spinal Tap, the British The Office, and something entirely original. Scenes would be blocked and rehearsed almost like a play, with entire scenes performed top to bottom many times. Two or three cameras would find the action and just follow the actors as they moved around. Actors often didn't know when they were on camera or where the cameras were. Spy shots lent a sense of intimacy to moments. Actors were allowed to look into the camera to show their reactions to things and spoke directly to camera with talking heads, used to further the story or display another side of what a character was feeling.
Characters on mockumentary shows look at the camera for different reasons. For Michael Scott from The Office, for example, it would be because he had just done something humiliating and then suddenly remembered that there were cameras there. His looks were often conveying, uh-oh. Ben Wyatt, like Jim Halpert from The Office, often looks to camera as a plea, like, can you believe what I have to deal with? Andy Dwyer looks to camera like it's his best friend, and he wants to share how awesome something is, and so on. My point is that when we created the character of Leslie, we imagined that her relationship to the camera was one of guarded caution. She had political aspirations, and people with political aspirations both A, like being on camera, but are also B, acutely aware that one slip-up or inappropriate recorded moment could ruin their careers. In the beginning, Leslie had that cautious relationship with the cameras, but as time went on, Amy just kind of stopped looking at them. Amy and I never really discussed this, nor was it a conscious decision on the part of the writing staff. It just kind of stopped happening. I thought about why it was happening toward the end of season two, and I realized that Leslie had evolved into a character for whom there was no difference in her private and public thoughts or motives or feelings. Amy had made Leslie into a completely consistent, hard-on-her-sleeve character who is not embarrassed or ashamed by anything she ever said or did in any scenario. I remember thinking that was great, and from that moment on, I used that as a sort of North Star for writing Leslie. It became a mission statement that we would never write a story that involved her being ashamed of how she felt. It's a pretty badass character trait, I think, and it only works because of the supreme sincerity of the actress who embodies it. Now listen, Amy, don't cut this part. I know you want to because it seems braggy to have someone else talk about how awesome you are, but don't cut it because it's true and everyone else can just deal with it.
Okay, fine. You're the boss. Camera operators were very close or very far away, but a dynamic part of the action. We would shoot 8 or 9 pages in a 12-hour day, which is about double what one shoots on a feature film. There were very few makeup touch-ups or lighting adjustments.
We told our excellent crew in the first week of shooting that we would be asking them to do things that would ordinarily get them fired. We told the makeup artists and hairstylists not to rush onto the set to fix minor problems. We told the director of photography and the grips and electricians to light the scenes as quickly as they could and not to worry about perfect shadow removal and things like that. The whole point of this style is to maximize the amount of time that actors are in front of the camera acting. Now, this only works if you have a cast full of people who are willing to sacrifice Hollywood magic for maximal comedy, who are, in short, not vain, and who would rather be funny than look flawless and perfect. This is one of my absolute favorite things about the entire cast of Parks and Recreation. Every single one of them was more than happy to make that deal.
Improvising was encouraged and accommodated, and if you tried something new, the camera could swing and catch it. Mike told me that once I shot a show like this, I would never want to shoot a TV show any other way again. This has proven correct. He sent me the script, and it took me 5 minutes to realize Leslie Knope was the best character ever written for me.
I think the best character ever written for you is Jeff Goldblum's part in Independence Day. Or maybe Fagin and Oliver. Is this helping?
No, it's not. Thank you, though. My motto has always been, do work that you are proud of with your talented friends. My other motto is, I need to keep working or the government will seize my boat. Both of these things helped me say yes, please. I had a long discussion with my husband, Will, and I will be forever grateful that he agreed to move our family out to Los Angeles to allow me to give this show a try. We shot 6 episodes in a row instead of the usual method, shooting a pilot and then spending a month editing it and then thinking about stuff for a few months and then the Oracle, then writing and shooting the next episodes months later. Also, due to the timing of my pregnancy, we became probably the only show to ever willingly give up the coveted post-Super Bowl slot. Before we started shooting, I was feeling dumpy and exhausted, overwhelmed and sad. I was still grieving not being at SNL and recovering from my rough delivery, and I was lost in Los Angeles, a city I still can't quite figure out.
No one can. Don't even try. It's Chinatown, Poehler.
I spent a lot of time crying. I was scared I wasn't funny. I missed New York and my new baby at home. I wasn't being a good wife to my husband. I had a full face and a round body. And it had been a while since I had been asked to settle into one character for longer than a month. And I kept warning Mike and Greg that my performance might be too loud, like when you turn on your car and the radio is already going full blast. Once we started to cast the show, what was fuzzy became sharper. Rashida Jones, Aubrey Plaza, and Aziz Ansari came on board early. Chris Pratt and Nick Offerman later. Retta, Jim O'Hare, and Paul Schneider rounded out our first mini-season of Parks and Recreation. Eventually, we would be joined by Rob Lowe and Adam Scott, and the circle would be complete. I don't remember much about those first shows. I started feeling my groove after a few episodes. I realized the cast was beyond talented and would eventually become like family. I constantly searched for Mike's face when I was nervous. But the thing I do remember clearly is a small scene I did in the pilot episode. It's raining, and Leslie's standing and looking outside her office window. In voiceover, she speaks about how this park project is going to take a lot of work and last a long time. But it'll be worth it.
Well, I've worked at the Parks Department for 6 years, and I've handled a lot of things that I'm proud of. Recently, I led a citywide drive to disinfect the sandbox sand after we had those problems with the cats. But this pit, the chance to build a whole new park from scratch. This could be my Hoover Dam.
I remember standing and watching the props guys make it rain in our fake outside courtyard as we shot the B-roll part of that scene. The shot of Leslie from outside the window that the audience would see as she spoke those words. I listened to the words being read aloud by Greg and Mike and realized this was my new job. A tiny whisper, no louder than the who that Horton hears, told me we were going to make it. I believed.
If you're looking for things to change, I think that maybe who should be capitalized.
That there. The who, yes. Thank you.
It's a proper name of a little creature.
Do you hear that? And do you see how Mike just continually makes things better with his compulsive OCD?
Also, the kerning on these letters is all wrong.
We almost didn't make it. That first year was rough. Critics compared us to The Office, and not kindly. Our ratings were okay, but not great. Deadline Hollywood decided to publish our pilot testing results, which was basically like having someone publish the worst parts of your diary.
That's a good analogy. I think of it more like a restaurant critic bursting into a kitchen, eating a half-cooked meal, and then writing a review. The chicken was undercooked! The only good thing about that cheap shot, both the leaking of it and the crummy decision to print it without even calling us for comment, is that Louis C.K. came to our defense in the comments section and then joined us as Leslie's boyfriend early in season 2.
Yes, and if you haven't heard of Louis C.K., he's an up-and-coming comic.
He's a young upstart.
Who is making his way.
He's gonna be something someday.
Remember that name.
Yeah.
According to testing, a lot of people liked it when that Parks lady fell into the pit. It wasn't a good sign when people wanted the show's lead character to fall into a hole. We regrouped, we changed a little, we figured out what worked, and soldiered on. Network presidents came and went as we hung on for dear life. Some liked us more than others. Some canceled us on airplanes, only to change their minds before landing. Critics started to watch the show again and notice new things. We kept our heads down and did our jobs. We controlled the only thing we could, which was the show. We did the thing. Because remember, the talking about the thing isn't the thing. The doing of the thing is the thing. In season two, we started to gain momentum. Critics put us on lists, and we were nominated for awards. Everybody realized we would never be a ratings juggernaut, but we just kept plugging along as we watched new NBC show after NBC show die on the table next to us. To be fair, we were often on life support ourselves. We would finish a season never really knowing if we would have another one. So Schur would always push the writers to take big swings and let characters evolve and change. Rob Lowe and Adam Scott joining us made us better and less likely to get canceled. We just kept doing it. Mike would call me in July every summer and pitch me the upcoming season's story for Leslie. I can't explain the joy and relief I felt sitting on a porch in my Nantucket rental, swatting bugs and hearing about what was ahead. After spending years trying to generate my own material at SNL, this felt like someone was picking me up and carrying me, Jesus footprint style.
My grandfather really wanted me to be a deity, and this analogy is the closest I will ever get, and so for that, I thank you again.
Leslie got to run for office, fall in and out of love, fight for her town, and eat waffles with her friends. I got to write and direct episodic television for the first time. I got to work with people like Louis C.K., Megan Mullally, Fred Armisen, Patricia Clarkson, Will Arnett, and Detlef Schrempf. I have sex stories about all of them, but I'm saving those for my next book.
Your 7-year, real-life, will-they-won't-they saga with former NBA three-pointing sharpshooter Detlef Schrempf could fill 100 volumes. Side note, that is a joke. He's married, I think. Hi, Detlef. He's definitely listening to this right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Hi, Detlef.
Hi, Detlef.
Thanks for listening to this. Call me. In the middle of season two, I got pregnant again. I was excited and surprised.
So was I. Probably not in the same way.
This meant we had to sort of force NBC's hand and try to get them to agree to shoot more episodes before I really blew up. With its cameras looking everywhere shooting style, Parks and Recreation was not the kind of show where you could hide a pregnant belly behind a few bags of groceries. We got an early pickup for season three, and as soon as season two ended, we just kept rolling and shot some extra episodes that we would bank for the beginning of the next year. If you have any doubt as to what a great actor Adam Scott is, go back and watch him join a show and immediately figure out how to flirt with a tired pregnant lady. It's not easy. If I have learned anything from hip-hop, it's that there's nothing sexy about a baby that ain't yours. Season three found us fighting for our right to party. We had been pushed to mid-season, which is usually not exactly a vote of confidence from the network. The storyline was all about a government shutdown, so both Amy and Leslie were frustrated about not getting back to work. The whole time, Mike kept reminding me to keep my head down and control the only thing I could, which was the work. And somehow, we survived. Season four was all about Leslie's running for city council. The wonderful Paul Rudd and Catherine Hahn joined us for a while. Leslie won. We all won. We soldiered on. Seasons five and six were about the frustrations of Leslie Knope's new job. They were also about Ben and Leslie finally getting married and pregnant. They dealt with Anne and Chris leaving, Andy and April trying to figure out what they wanted, Donna finding love, and Tom entering a new business venture. I forget what happened with Jerry. We had Sam Elliott, Michelle Obama, and Ginuwine on our show.
The big three.
I can't believe we have done all these episodes, and of course, I can believe it, because I always knew we would. It's a miracle. In season five, Leslie kicks off the season by visiting Washington, D.C., and her boyfriend, Ben, decides to surprise her by setting up a meeting with her ultimate crush, Vice President Joe Biden. We shot that scene with Vice President Biden in his ceremonial office on the grounds of the White House, and he was charming and funny and a true pro. He didn't even flinch when Leslie slightly leaned in for a kiss. I mean, that's some old-school improv commitment right there. While we were walking out of the building, we learned that our show, which had been talked about as a front-runner for winning the Emmy for Best Comedy, did not even get nominated. We were upset. Because, as we know, no matter how much you think you don't want the pudding, Once people start telling you that you might get the pudding, it makes you want that pudding bad. Instead of being upset, Mike said, I'm going to go write the scene where Ben proposes to Leslie. He went back to his hotel room and wrote this.
Hey!
Hey.
I didn't know you were coming back here.
Oh.
What are you doing? Oh my God, what are you doing?
I'm thinking about my future. I am deeply, ridiculously in love with you. And above everything else, I want to be with you forever. So, Leslie, nope.
Wait. Okay?
Okay.
Just, I need to remember this.
Sure.
Give me a second.
Okay. Leslie,
no. No. Hold on. Okay. Just, I need another second, please. I need to remember every little thing about how perfect my life is right now. At this exact moment.
Okay. Are you good?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm good.
Leslie, nope. Will you?
Yes.
Marry me?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Mike also wrote these vows in the wedding episode.
We are gathered here tonight to join Leslie Knope and Benjamin Wyatt in marriage. It's been a long and winding road for these two lovebirds. And they're so impatient to begin their lives together, they moved their wedding date up 3 months. So I say, let's keep it short and sweet.
Yes, just do it already.
I assume and hope you prepared your own vows. Ben, you want to say some stuff about Leslie?
In my time working for the state government, my job sent me to 46 cities in 11 years. I lived in villages with 8 people, rural farming communities, college towns. I was sent to every corner of Indiana. And then I came here, and I realized that this whole time, I was just wandering around everywhere, just looking for you.
Leslie, do you want to say some stuff about Ben now?
Okay, well, the first draft of my vows, which I wrote the day after we got engaged, clocked in at around 70 pages.
Oh.
But I don't have them with me today.
Oh, boy.
Although maybe there's a copy of them in my office.
Oh.
No.
That's fine. I think we can just keep going.
Okay. Here's what I'll say, though. The things that you have done for me to help me, support me, surprise me, to make me happy, go above and beyond what any person deserves. You're all I need. I love you and I like you.
I love you and I like you.
Do you see the kind of maniac I am working with here? I have been shoulder to shoulder with a wonderful writer and excellent boss who loves big emotion as much as I do. Nightmare! Maya Angelou, may she rest in peace, said, people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. I'm proud that Mike Schur and I rejected the idea that creativity needs to come from chaos. I like how we ran our writer's room and our set. People had a great time when they came to work on our show, and that mattered to us. I like to think the spirit we had on set found its way onto the show. We used to leave enough time for fun runs, improvised last takes where the actors could try out all the brilliant ideas they had been thinking about for the whole scene. 99% of the time, the scenes were longer and less funny than what was written. But it made the actors feel funny. It kept the crew laughing and on their toes. It felt fun and alive and warm. Most days, I was handed an amazing script that allowed me to stand in front of people I really loved and tell them how much I love them. I got to work with the best writers and the best directors and the best producers. I won't miss memorizing those tongue-twisty talking heads.
I will miss writing them and then watching you try to memorize them. It made for great blooper reel material.
But I will miss everything else. This kind of job is magic. It comes around once or twice in a lifetime, if you're lucky. And thank God, because it's all-consuming. And sometimes work should just be work. David Letterman liked the show, and I received a steady paycheck for 6 years. That's about all you can ask for in life. Anyway, I moved on. I'm working on a new HBO show called Farts and Procreation, and it deals with some pretty dark stuff. Whatever, no big deal.
I'm gonna bet right now that you win an Emmy for the role of Detective Janet Toughwoman, Special Ops, Fart Squad Delta.
I'll take that bet. My castmates and friends. Rashida Jones, Ann Perkins. Rashida is my old friend and chosen sister. She is my wife for life. I loved the scenes when it was just Ann and Leslie figuring out a problem. I would go sit on a fake apartment set and be friends with Ann, and then go sit in my real trailer and be friends with Rashida. It was so easy to play being in love with Ann, because next to my mom and my possible future daughter, Rashida Jones is the prettiest person I have ever met. She's also beautiful inside. We had so many deep conversations about our real lives in our fake offices. Rashida can speak on everything from Rodart to Rodin to Rhodesia. And I'm so proud of the real friendship that Leslie and Anne had on screen. It was important to both Rashida and me to show two women who supported each other and seemed like they would actually be friends. My favorite moments on set? Rashida and me singing and dancing between takes. A lot of people don't know. Rashida shares my obsession with miniature fake food. I laughed the hardest the time Rashida and I, Anne and Leslie, had to try to pin Nick Offerman, Ron Swanson, down and feed him medicine in the hunting trip episode. Nick Offerman, Ron Swanson. I met Nick Offerman in Chicago in 1997. He had dyed his beard bright orange and his hair was shaped into two devil horns. He looked terrifying. He was doing a production of A Clockwork Orange with some cool theater company. Nick has real theater training and complete control over his instrument. This is why Ron Swanson is one of the best characters ever to be on television. He can do stillness like no other. He's incredibly professional, but also giggly. We both talk about how much we love our jobs at least 5 times a day. He adores his wife and takes nothing for granted. He is someone I would run to when the zombies attack, because he can build a boat and is great company. My favorite moments on set? Blocking scenes with Nick in Ron's office. A lot of people don't know, Nick is crazy for his two poodles. I laughed the hardest the time Ron Swanson tried to push Leslie up onto a podium while the entire cast was slipping on ice in the episode The Comeback Kid. Aziz Ansari, Tom Haverford. Aziz was a UCB wunderkind who had already had his own sketch show, Human Giant, before he joined Parks. He's a keen observer of the human condition and a lot sweeter and quieter than you would imagine. Like Tom Haverford, he's a total foodie and part-time culture vulture. Aziz and I spent a lot of time together building the world of Pawnee in those first couple of seasons. We stood together in a dusty pit and did our first television promos with a bunch of wild raccoons. We once shot a scene where Aziz had to run the length of a golf course, and he barely broke a sweat. He has the stride and work ethic of a long-distance runner. My favorite moments on set? Hearing my kids call Aziz turkey sandwich. I think it's because he was eating a turkey sandwich once. I don't know. Either way, they think he's hilarious. A lot of people don't know, Aziz went to business school. I laughed the hardest the night Aziz and I spent shooting in a van during the episode The Stakeout. Aubrey Plaza, April Ludgate. Aubrey is my devil child and my girlfriend in crime. She will do anything for me and me for her. She was an NBC page and made up facts during her studio tours. She was an SNL intern and smoked cigarettes with the set painters. Her great work as April Ludgate turned what could have been a one-note performance into a deep character study. Both the character of April and the person of Aubrey are secret softies. When I was going through my divorce and sad about coming back to Los Angeles, Aubrey dressed up as an alien and surprised me at the airport. She is a big-hearted warrior and a good and loyal friend. She speaks Spanish and gets the most sleep of anyone on our show. My favorite moments on set? Hugging Aubrey and asking her if she was eating enough. A lot of people don't know, Aubrey has a shrine to Judy Garland in her house. I laughed the hardest. The scene in the Two Parties episode where April discovers that the illuminated penis hat she is wearing is helping her as she digs to bury stolen artifacts. Chris Pratt, Andy Dwyer. Chris had the best audition I have ever seen. No one knew his work, and he came in and crushed. He is a comedy savant and a natural actor in a way I've never really seen before. Each take is different and hilarious and completely unexpected. His character was only supposed to be on the show for 6 episodes, which seems ridiculous now. There are long discussions in the writer's room about how much Andy knows and doesn't know. Chris is exactly how you would expect him to be in person, friendly, open, and very strong. When we were going through tough times, we would text each other, "How's the weather?" He also likes hunting and country music. I've learned a lot from watching him. He constantly reminds me to stay loose and have fun. My favorite moments on set? Watching Pratt do physical comedy. Nobody falls like Pratt. Nobody does Pratt falls like Pratt falls. A lot of people don't know, Chris actually plays the guitar and has helped write Mouse Rat songs. I laughed the hardest anytime Andy got distracted in the middle of listening to important instructions, like in the episode The Trial of Leslie Knope. Rob Lowe, Chris Traeger. I can't believe I am Rob Lowe's co-worker, let alone his friend. For the first few weeks after I met him, I hounded him with questions about his movies. The scene when Soda Pop comes out of the shower in The Outsiders was a very important moment in my adolescence. Rob gives wise advice, and he loves to talk about show business. He joined the show at a time when our status was very shaky, and he helped keep us on the air. He's a committed father and has great wisdom about raising 2 boys. He delighted in the rigorous physical challenges we put him and his character through. He played Chris Traeger as a wide-eyed lunatic and loved every minute of it. My favorite moments on set? When Chris Traeger would have to go from standing still to a full sprint in less than 5 seconds. A lot of people don't know, we have a nickname for Rob. It's Rolo, and he loves it. I laughed the hardest when Chris Traeger played air banjo in the backseat during the road trip episode. Retta Sirleaf, Donna Meagle. Retta can sing opera and cry on cue. She's a very warm person who does not suffer fools. The character of Donna Meagle has grown because Retta kept adding small details in the fine work she does. I love how Donna is the only character who really holds her own against Ron Swanson. I love how she has nothing in common with Leslie Knope, but tolerates her anyway. When we were rehearsing in the first few weeks of the show, Greg Daniels had me give a tour of the office and introduce everyone to camera. Retta, whom I barely knew, was sitting at Donna's station pretending to be on the phone. I came over and checked out the stuff on her desk and noticed a yellow leaf pinned up on a bulletin board behind her. I asked her where it came from, and she deadpanned, "Outside." My favorite moments on set? Retta talking about anything she loves or hates. A lot of people don't know, her aunt is the president of Liberia. I laughed the hardest when Donna Meagle cried after a bullet hit her Benz in the hunting trip episode. Jim O'Hare, Gary/Jerry/Larry/Terry Gurgich. The character of Jerry is allowed to be such a loser because Jim, the person, is such a winner. He's sweet and funny and has the best timing of anyone on our show. He's a fine actor from Chicago who made what could have been a bad one-joke character into someone you root for and against. In real life, teasing him is okay because we all love him. In the show, Gary/Jerry/Larry/Terry is married to Christie Brinkley and has a gigantic penis. He is my parents' favorite. My favorite moments on set? Everybody making fun of Jerry. A lot of people don't know, Jim has a huge tongue. I laughed the hardest when Jerry suffered a fart attack in Halloween Surprise. Jim played it so real, and it was ridiculous. Adam Scott, Ben Wyatt. Adam is my TV husband, and I couldn't ask for a better partner to fake come home to. The characters of Ben and Leslie have gone through so much together, and I feel so lucky to have had Adam by my side. The fact that people cared about our TV love story is because Adam is a tremendous actor. He listens intently and always makes me better. Ben and Leslie scenes were exciting and nerve-wracking to shoot because we all cared so much about making them work. Adam is a kind person who loves his family and cares about the people he works with. He also speaks slowly and tells really long and boring stories, and someone needs to tell him to cut the shit. Adam always has fresh breath for kissing scenes and a very dry sense of humor. My favorite moments on set? anytime Leslie and Ben kiss. A lot of people don't know, Adam grew up in Santa Cruz and insists it's totally acceptable to drive barefoot. I laughed the hardest when Ben had a kidney stone and lost his mind on morphine in the Partridge episode. I cried the hardest when Ben got down on one knee and proposed to Leslie.
As Greg Daniels and I were putting the finishing touches on the pilot script, the last thing we did was to make 100% sure that the main character had the exact correct name. We were pretty sure that Leslie Knope was the right choice. It made us laugh. We liked that someone so positive had a last name that had a negative connotation. But just for fun, we made a long list of possible other names. Most of them were jokey and silly, but we just wanted to make sure that we had left no stone unturned. So what you can hear now are some of the names that we almost gave Leslie Knope.
And I should point out that Mike Schur is obsessed with names.
Yes.
And in the show Parks and Recreation, you take tender care in giving people ridiculous names.
Yes, I do. If you love silly names like I do, and I love nothing in the world more than silly names, just look up the IMDb credits for anyone who has ever appeared on Parks and Recreation in any capacity, even if it was only one line. I can almost guarantee that that person will have an insane name.
Any names come to mind right now that you especially loved?
Well, there's a character named Herman Lerpus, and Herman Lerpus led to a gigantic number of Lerpuses. There have been like 6 or 7 people on the show who have had the last name Lerpus. One of them was named Lalissa Melissa Kista Snurple Lerpus. She was a waitress who had one line. If you go to imdb.com and you look up the last name Lerpus, you'll find about 6 different people who share that last name.
Okay, let's read some other options that almost became Leslie Knope's name.
Some possible other options at the 11th hour for Leslie Knope's name.
Okay, Amy Poehler stars as Leslie Knope, Knope to cut. We should point out, by the way, the K in Knope is silent.
Yes, so when you hear any of these names with an N sound at the beginning, you can imagine a silent K at the beginning.
You know, that unobtrusive silent K.
Amy Poehler stars as Leslie Knope, Leslie Knoptikut, Leslie Norble,
Leslie Newt Sauce, Knapdragon,
Leslie Norshinty.
Oh, Leslie Knievel, said as it's spelled.
How about Leslie Snapdragon?
Leslie Nasterson,
mm-hmm.
Leslie Knob, Leslie Nobody, K-N-O, Leslie Nobody, that would be so sad.
Yeah.
Leslie Nobody. What else do we have here? Leslie.
There's some, not all of them start with K-N. There's also Leslie Brocknet, Leslie Borknust, Leslie Borkdust, Leslie Bornkvetch.
Leslie Sklorm.
Mm.
Leslie Krapft.
Leslie Nimbaletti. Leslie Nazzle.
Leslie Newt Norp. Which is KNUTE/GNORP.
Leslie Nurstowitz. Leslie Screek. Leslie Sklorm. That's a good one.
There's one that says Leslie Can Phillips Head Screwdriver It. This is like a crazy list.
Leslie Nugenic with a silent K.
Mm-hmm.
My personal favorite, though, the very last one on this list, Leslie Knuckle Jensen. That's K-N-U-C-K-L hyphen J-E-N-S-E-N. What if your name had been Leslie Knuckle Jensen the entire time?
It would have been, we would have, like, beat How I Met Your Mother.
Do you think that was the thing that kept the ratings down?
Yep.
Was that you weren't named Leslie Knuckle Jensen?
Yep, it's what kept us from supreme high ratings.
You know what? Hindsight is 20/20.
Yep, what are you going to do now? You know, or what we could do, now that I have my own audio booth, we could go back and make
re-record
that my name.
Yeah, there we go. Yep. That's the right answer, is to re-record all of the episodes.
We know how television works. Thank you, Mike, for sitting in on this chapter.
It was a true honor. And like I said, I didn't have any comments, so I didn't need to weigh in ever.
It felt like you did talk a little bit.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, I blacked out.
Oh.
Thank you for having me. This was super fun.
You're welcome. Now never speak to me again. Things they don't tell you about the biz. There are lots of television shows and movies about television shows and movies. People feel like they know what it's like to work in Hollywood. America has watched enough Billy Bush to know that Will Smith has a big trailer, and the cast of The Simpsons are usually not in the same room when they record. Even in suburban Boston, my dad gets Variety delivered to his house every week and likes to call me up when a network prexy gets axed.